Chapter 45 of This Country of Ours. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This Country of Ours by H. E. Marshall. Chapter 45. How the Mississippi Was Discovered. While the shores of the Atlantic, from Nova Scotia to Georgia, were being claimed and peopled by the British, another and very different nation laid claim also to the mighty continent. Before Jamestown was founded, the French had already set foot upon the St. Lawrence. Long before the Pilgrim Fathers sailed from Plymouth, the flag of France was floating from the citadel of Quebec, and the French laid claim to the whole of Canada. But the French and the British claimed these new lands in very different ways. The Englishmen came seeking freedom and a new home. The Frenchmen came seeking adventure. The Englishman painfully felled trees and cleared land, toiling by the sweat of his brow for the comfort of a home. The Frenchman set up crosses on the edge of pathless forests, claiming unknown lands for God and his king. He came as missionary, trader, and adventurer, rather than as farmer. And, led on by zeal for religion or desire for adventure, he pushed his settlements far into the wilderness. So long years went by. All along the Atlantic coasts spread fertile fields and fair homesteads. The British were content to live on the lands which they had cleared and tilled, and no adventurer sought to know what lay beyond the Blue Mountain Range, which shut him from the west. Far otherwise was it with the French. Priests and traders were both full of a desire for conquest and adventure. Many of them, indeed, were so driven by the roving spirit that they left the towns altogether and lived alone among the forests, tracking the wild animals, and only coming to towns to sell the skins and get provisions. These trappers brought back with them many strange tales of the forests and unknown wilds. They spoke of the Mississippi, or Great Water, of which the Indians told marvelous tales. And at length it seemed to their hearers that this great water could be no other than the long-sought passage to India and the East. Many people, fired by these tales, went in search of this great water. In 1673, two priests, named Marquette and Joliet, were the first to discover it. For many miles they floated down the Mississippi. On either side stretched endless forests and plains of waving grass, haunts of wild animals and of the Indians, almost as wild. On they went, past the mouth of the Yellow Missouri, on still till they came to the river Arkansas. At last, sure that the great river went southward and not westward as they had supposed, they decided to return. It had been easy enough floating down, but now they had to battle against the stream, and it was only after weeks of toil that they at length reached Canada again with their news. When he heard their story, another adventurer named René Robert Cavelier, Sieur de La Salle, became eager to make certain of their discovery and follow the river all the way to its mouth. With great care and trouble he made his arrangements. He thought it would be impossible to compass so great a journey by canoes, so he built a little ship, which he called the Griffin. It was the first ship which had been seen by the Indians round Lake Erie, and in amazement and fear they came to stare at it. In their ignorant terror they would have destroyed it, had not careful watch been kept. From the very beginning of his expedition, La Salle found many difficulties, but at length they all seemed to be overcome, and he set out with his friend, Henri de Tonty, and about 40 men. Tonty was a man of courage, as bold and enterprising as La Salle himself. He was, too, much feared by the Indians, who thought him a great medicine man. For while fighting in Europe, he had had one hand shot off, but he had replaced it with an iron hand, which he always wore covered with a glove. The Indians did not know this, and once or twice, when they had been troublesome, he had brought them to order by knocking them down with this hand. Not knowing the secret of it, they marveled greatly at his strength, and, fearing him accordingly, called him Iron Hand. One of La Salle's great difficulties was lack of money, so before leaving the Great Lakes he collected a quantity of furs. Then he sent back the Griffin and half his men with orders to sell these furs and return with supplies for the expedition as quickly as possible. With the rest of his men, La Salle journeyed on to the head of Lake Michigan in canoes. It was no easy journey, for storms swept the lake. The waves tossed their frail canoes hither and thither, so that they were often in danger of drowning. They were harassed, too, by unfriendly Indians. At length, worn out by fatigue, starving with cold and hunger, they reached the appointed place to await the return of the Griffin. But the Griffin never came. In vain La Salle scanned the gray waters. Day after day passed, and no white sail flecked the dreary expanse. The Griffin was never heard of more. With a heavy heart, La Salle at length gave up the weary watch, and decided to go on with such men and supplies as he had. But with every step fresh difficulties arose. La Salle had many enemies, and they did their best to hinder and hamper him. His own men were discontented and mutinous. They had no love for their leader, no enthusiasm for the expedition, and the hardships and dangers of the way made them sullen. They were half-starved and worn out with fatigue. All they wanted was to get back to a comfortable life. They were sick of the wilderness and its hardships. Added to this, the Indians told them blood-curdling tales of the terrors of the Father of Waters. It was a raging torrent of whirlpools, they said, full of poisonous serpents and loathly monsters. Those who ventured on it would never return. This was more than the men could face. They chose rather the possibility of death among the Indians and the wilderness to its certainty among such horrors, and some of them ran away. Depressed by this desertion, La Salle resolved to camp for the rest of the winter. So, on the banks of the river Illinois, he built a fort, which he called Crèvecoeur, or Heartbreak. But La Salle's brave heart was not yet broken, and here he began to build a new ship in which to sail down the Mississippi. There was wood in plenty around, and the work was begun. But many things, such as sails and rigging, which were necessary for the ship, the wilderness could not supply. And, seeing no other way, La Salle resolved to go back to Fort Frontenac to get them, leaving Tonty, meanwhile, to look after the building of the ship. It was March when La Salle set out on his tremendous walk of 1,000 miles. With him he took a faithful Indian guide and 4 Frenchmen. And seldom have men endured a journey more terrible. The spring sun was just beginning to thaw the ice and snow of winter, so that the prairies were turned to marshes into which the travelers sank knee-deep. The forests were pathless thickets through which they had to force a way with axe and hatchet. As a pathway, the rivers were useless to them, for the ice was so thin that it would not bear their weight. And later, when it thawed and broke up, they still could not use their canoes, lest they should be shattered by the floating masses of ice. All day long they toiled knee-deep in mud and half-melted snow, laden with baggage, guns, and ammunition. At night they lay down without shelter of any kind. They were often hungry. They suffered constantly both from cold and heat. For at noon the sun beat down upon them fiercely, and at night the frost was so bitter that the blankets in which they lay wrapped were frozen stiff. The hardships of that journey were so tremendous that the marvel is that anyone lived to tell of them. Indeed, one by one the men fell ill, and when at length, after 3 months of pain and peril, they arrived at their journey's end, only La Salle had strength or courage left. Here, more bad news greeted La Salle, for he now heard that a ship sent out from France, laden with supplies for him, had been wrecked. But even this cruel stroke of fortune could not break his spirit. Once more he set about gathering supplies, and made ready to return to Fort Heartbreak. But worse was yet to come. La Salle was about to start when he received a letter from Tonty. From this he learned that soon after he had left, nearly all his men had mutinied. They had rifled the stores and demolished the fort. Then, throwing into the river everything they could not carry, had made off. Only three or four had remained faithful. With these, Tonty was now alone in the wilderness. This staggering news only made La Salle more eager to set out, for he could not leave his brave friend thus helpless. So, once more, the toilsome journey was begun. But when heartbreak was reached, La Salle found no friend to welcome him. All around there was nothing but silence and desolation, and ghastly ash-strewn ruins. The unfinished ship, like some vast skeleton, huge and gaunt, alone bore witness that white men had once been there. Still, La Salle would not despair. He spent the winter making friends with the Indians and searching earnestly for some trace of Tonty. The winter was unusually severe, the whole land was covered with snow, and both La Salle and some of his men became snowblind for days. But at last, with the melting of the snows, light and joy came to him. The blindness passed. Tonty was found. Once again the friends met. Each had a tale to tell, a tale of bitter disappointments and defeats. Yet in spite of all the blows of fortune, La Salle would not give in. Once more he set about making preparations for the expedition, but now he gave up the idea of building a ship, and decided to trust to canoes alone. It was midwinter when all was ready. The rivers were frozen hard, so, placing their canoes on sledges, the men dragged them over the ice. As they went southward and spring came on, the ice melted and would no longer bear them. The stream was soon filled with floating masses of broken ice, so they were obliged to land and wait until it had melted. Then once more they set out. Every day now they drifted farther and farther into the heat of summer. The sun shone softly through the overhanging trees, the river banks were gay with flowers, and bright plumaged birds flashed through the sunlight. After the tortures of the past winters, this green and fertile land seemed a very paradise. So on the adventurers passed, where never white man had passed before, and at length they reached the mouth of the mighty river and stood upon the shore of the Gulf of Mexico. And here, in 1682, while wondering savages looked on, this mere handful of white men claimed all the land through which they had passed for their king. The long silence of the wilderness was awakened for the first time by the sound of Latin chants. Guns were fired, and to the shouts of "God save the king," a pillar was set up. End of chapter 45. Read by Kara Schallenberg, www.kray.org, in January 2010, in San Diego, California.